This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, Episode 9, recorded Sunday, June 12th, delivered Sunday, June 19th, 2005. Sorry about the delay, folks. I'll get another one out to you any day now, like today. Enjoy.
The BBC would like to announce that the next scene is not considered suitable for family viewing.
And it looks as though we're in for a splendid afternoon sport on this, the 127th upper-class TWiT of the Year show.
And now for something completely different.
We are all TWiTs now.
What a great TWiT!
Excellent.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another fine edition of TWiT. Leo, are you breathing heavy in the background this week?
Is that me?
Am I the breather this week? There's always somebody breathing heavily.
I think you're the breather this week.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is your favorite tech podcast. Leo Laporte breathing heavily. Kevin Rose hiding in the darkness with his lockpick kit. Robert Heron looking around trying to figure out why his cold will not go away.
That's because you're smoking, Robert. It's menthol, baby.
It's a curse. I kid you not. Thursday afternoon, I look somebody square in the face and say, I never get sick. 10 minutes later, it just hit me. God hit you.
I think it was me you looked at and said you wouldn't get sick.
By the end of the day, I was miserable.
Oh, got to knock on wood, baby.
Yeah, well, if you never do get sick, then you wouldn't be sick now.
No logic.
They're doozies. When I do get sick, they're doozies. So.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So, Robert, you got the lead story today. Microsoft warns on security. What are they, like 42 updates are coming out on Tuesday for Microsoft?
Well, it's getting to the point where pretty much any time you turn on your Windows machine, it's going to check for an update and find one. So what are they saying? Come Tuesday, they have 10 more updates.
This is the regular. They do it every second Tuesday of the month. And they've, you know, I don't know. What do you guys think? You think this is a good idea or not? I mean, for a while it was. It was the patch of the moment. And then they said, well, wait, maybe we just better do it once a month. But then that leaves you kind of open for a month, doesn't it?
Well, you know what bugs me is the fact that, you know, anybody who's updating their system, if they don't have a broadband connection, they either have to wait for 42 hours for the download or order the CD to get Service Pack 1 or Service Pack 2.
a good way to get around that, though, is to just leave your system on overnight.
A huge percentage of America does not have broadband, Leo.
Well, it's time to change. It's time to get some broadband.
Yeah. I think 52% of America has broadband now.
That means 48% doesn't.
That's true. I mean, it's still pretty close to 50-50, but in the case of Windows Update, since Service Pack 2, the system encourages you by default to have your automatic updates turned on. And the default time, I believe, is at like 3 a.m. So if you just left your system running overnight, that usually solves the problem of a slow connection, if you can.
So why are they waiting till just, you know, one day a month to do this? Why not just stage them throughout the month?
I don't see it as such a bad thing, really. You consider that most of the hacks that they're fixing or security holes that they're fixing are cutting-edge threats that perhaps, you know, maybe it would take another month of being out in the wild before a serious threat could be mounted, but they're going to have a patch out that hopefully will cut that off ahead of time. Unless it's like, you know, a 7-year bug or something that's been there forever and it's been in any version of Windows. But
now, are they sticking hard and fast to this, though? I mean, if something comes out, say, on the Wednesday after they do their major patch for that month, are they going to release it later or are they going to have to wait a month to get that patch?
They're going
to
wait a month.
That's true.
That's what they've been doing.
If it's ultra critical, though, won't they throw something out there immediately?
I think they will, but
apparently nothing's been ultra critical yet.
Tell me, I mean, it isn't widely known until Microsoft releases the patch anyway, right? I mean, how widely known are these exploits? Once the patch comes out, everybody knows about it. But
I think for the professionals out there who infect machines for money, they're aware of this stuff because it's in their interest. But I think for the general amount of script kiddies out there, people who simply take an easy-to-use tool to cause mayhem, I don't think they're going to be seeing or be able to use any of these exploits, hopefully in time, because of things like automatic update.
Well, I'll give you, I mean, here's part of the problem. Look, I just, my hard drive just died and I'm reinstalling Windows. And I had a Windows image. Thank goodness I used Ghost to make a Windows image of the install, so I didn't have to go through the full install. But it's a Service Pack 1 image. So the very first thing I do, before I even go online, I tell everybody to do this, I install Service Pack 2. Halfway through, blue screen of death, the thing's dead. And I have to reinstall all over again. No wonder people don't want to install patches.
Well, you can download Service Pack 2. as a standalone.
I did. That's what I do. I have a standalone 172 megabyte file on a CD. Didn't stop a blue screen of death. It's infuriating.
That sucks.
Yeah, no kidding.
Was it an older piece of hardware?
Well, it's the same piece of hardware that was running the same image in Service Pack 2 before. I don't know what happened all of a sudden. It's just, you know, it used to work and doesn't work anymore.
I went through literally 2 weeks of pulling my hair out trying to figure out a problem I was having, and it turned out it was a power supply related issue. And I went through two seemingly brand new power supplies that people had given me, and I finally went out and bought one of my own, and guess what? It worked as soon as I, you know, dropped one that I had pulled out of a package.
It's such a complex system. You never know what's wrong, do you?
No. That's why I love the shuttle boxes. Everything's pre-wired and I just drop parts in, it goes.
Yeah. Well, and that's the advantage Apple has. They make their own power supply. I mean, where they spec their own power supplies. They don't make them, but at least you know what you're getting.
Yeah. Proper. I mean, any reputable PC vendor is also testing their equipment before they ship it out as well. Hopefully catching.
We can only hope.
Most of it. The more it's directly related to how much you pay, though. The more you pay, I'm sure, the better they are tested. You have, you know, the high-end PC gaming companies or gaming PC makers out there.
Is there any evidence that an Alienware or a Falcon Northwest is more reliable? I mean, you sure pay a lot more for it.
I know exactly what they do to test those systems, and it's about as rigorous as you can think of.
Each and every one?
Yes.
Well, that's good.
Especially, well, one company in particular, I mean, I don't want to name names, but they were talking about how they put every system through a 5-day test and 24 hours a day trying to break it. And they're fearful of things like driver updates because, you know, they're worried that the new drivers might introduce problems. I take the opposite approach. I say the driver updates in particular for graphics cards are really necessary just because, there are so many little things that could happen when you code a big game nowadays that could cause a problem or a bug or a crash or poor performance. So frequent patches and driver updates, in particular for the gaming scene, is just critical.
They're really two different schools of thought, aren't they? I mean, if you never change your computer and never install anything, it's always going to operate the same way. Or you update everything all the time and hope and pray that it's going to continue to work. I don't know. I don't know which is the right way.
It's funny. I've been going back and forth because I think, you know, it's always nice to build your own computer, spec everything out. You know what you're getting. And then it is nice to buy something that's already pre-built for you. But my problem, the biggest thing that just drives me nuts is that all these pre-built computers come loaded with so much crap software.
Oh, it's awful.
I just got an IBM ThinkPad, and there's like 30 applications I will never use. You try and uninstall them, and then the system gets all nasty. Oh, it's terrible.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the first thing I did on this tablet PC was uninstall half the stuff that it came with. Yeah, absolutely.
Can you reinstall the OS easily? Is it just using Windows XP on your tablet?
Now, see, here's the... Well, with mine, I was going to say with the ThinkPad, it comes with another image on there that has all that crap already installed on the image. So when you try and restore the image... You restore all the crap. They don't give you the original Windows XP CD. So. No,
none of them do that.
Actually, some of them do.
Yeah, so I have a HP tablet, and it has Tablet Edition. The problem with this one is it has no spindle, so you can't install anything unless you do it over the network, or you make a disk image, or you know some sort of massive hack. And then it has this thing called Altiris, which is a backup, but it backs it up to another hidden partition on the hard drive. So as long as the hard drive doesn't die, I'm okay. And it's a constant backup. So what's nice about that is I can make any modification of the system, like uninstalling these things, and it will modify my... It's like a system restore. It's like a global system restore. So that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. So now I've uninstalled all that crap, and now I have an image of that, in a sense. I can go back to that point in time, the uninstalled. But I don't have any, you know, they gave me a Windows disk, but how am I supposed to install? I can't.
That's funny.
Yeah.
It seems like, too, the less you pay for a computer, the more extra crap you get installed on it, either through deals made, through the manufacturer, or something to that effect.
We're in a crap. This is a crap society. It's a crap generation. There's crap everywhere. There's ads everywhere. There's no, you know, there's never, I'm cranky old man. That's all crap.
You okay there, Leo?
Crap. Everywhere you go, there's an ad on every surface. I hate it.
Yeah, but a lot of what's crap to us, like Kevin certainly doesn't want, you know, the software running in the background that allows Dell to fix his machine. But, you know, there's a lot of insert name of non-computer experts here who think that's, you know, the bomb.
True.
But I don't know.
I hate that stuff.
I know. I mean, it's amazing what's like buried really deep down in the system that you don't realize until you wipe the system and rebuild it.
Yeah. What are you guys doing for backups nowadays? I'm going to get one of those external networkable hard drives that do the retrospect incremental backups.
Those are you doing the? Are you doing another one of the OneTouch, the Maxstores?
Yeah, they have the Maxstore OneTouch now. That it's actually a networkable. It has the large A45, 10, 100, 1000, I think, in the back. Throw it in the closet, yeah. Hide it, so if anybody breaks in, they don't steal your data. And then, I have to be careful here. You know, I got so many computers and all this stuff. I try to, you know, at least throw a hard drive somewhere where, you know, if someone breaks in, they can't find it. And then do your incremental backups to that.
I'm actually building, I've got three Pentium 2 boxes, and one of them I'm turning into a new smoothwall firewall, and the other one's becoming, I'm going to use probably, OpenFiler's really cool looking, but I think I'm just going to use NAS Lite, which is a really cool, someone is breathing really heavily, and it's kind of hot.
Got to be Leo.
I know, it's just really distracting. It's like having someone breathe in my ear.
I'll move the microphone
it's
way away.
Naughty, man.
Wait till I start farting.
That's just disgusting. But actually, it's pretty cool. ServerElements.com is a website, and there's you can get downloads on freshmeat.net, and it's essentially just turns a box into a network attached storage box. So I'm going to try that and see if it works. But it's really cool. So they've got a version of it. They actually have a version of it that'll do large disk support on older systems.
That's cool. I foolishly went out and bought the IoGear Boss, which is network attached storage / router. Oh, what a piece of crap.
I can't believe you bought one of those.
I am such a moron.
I would never buy anything that says Boss on it.
Yeah, well, boy, I tell you.
We should actually have a round of applause for being honest and open enough to admit that you actually bought one of those.
you knew it was a bad idea? I should have asked you first. I didn't know.
You should have asked me.
It seemed like a good idea because, I mean, I am using it as storage. I'll tell you the flaws, though. I'll tell you what's wrong with it. First of all, see, here's what I thought. Look, it's got built-in VPN, built-in FTP, built-in web server. It's a 200 gigabyte hard drive, $300. And I have, and it's,
it's
and
your it's firewall.
A, it's a firewall. It's a router. So here's what's wrong with it. Crappy router. It has very few port forwarding capabilities, really limited kind of stuff. It doesn't stealth. It only stealths two ports. It stealths the BIOS, the net BIOS ports, but it leaves all the other ports are closed, but they're visible. So it's like, it's saying, shoot me, come on, get me, come on. And then it's got a couple of just like really gross flaws. For instance, if the power goes off, it stays off. The thing doesn't come back on. So your whole network storage is down, right? It doesn't. And
oh,
and your router's down, right? And you don't know. I said, what happened to my network? Because the power was off, or you accidentally turned it off, or whatever. It goes on and on and on. It's just goofy. But I am using it as network attached storage, and I've backed up all my photos to it and all my music to it. And I mean, it works for that. It's fine for that. And so that's, it's a centralized backup.
I plug every piece of sensitive equipment I have into an uninterrupted power supply, including my network gear.
Yeah.
So even if the power goes off for like 15 to 20 minutes, I can still sit there and, finish up what I was doing without worry.
Yeah, but it should.
But true, if it totally drains, at least my router comes back on and everything just resets.
Right.
And the worst thing I have to worry about is maybe getting a different IP address next time around.
A router shouldn't, go away and not come back when the power comes back. It just doesn't make sense. Anyway, it's disappointing. It's overpriced and it's disappointing.
As far as file backup goes, do you guys ever use like the offline files app that's built into Windows itself? I believe my IT department at work has a way set up on our local network that anything I drop into My Documents will get backed up to a mirrored cool. My Documents folder sitting on my drive. So I use that frequently. And
I do that on the Mac. They have an iDisk backup on the Mac that I do. It automatically syncs your iDisk. That has the advantage of syncing it to all of the Macs that you're using. So I have access to all the same files on all of my computers, which is kind of nice. And it makes local copies automatically. Yeah, it's a nice, you only get 250 megs of...
Have you messed with Google's, like using a Google or a program to use a Google Drive as a remote storage?
Google file system?
Google.
That's lame.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, say you... I mean, not their file system, like their OS that they use internally, but using like the 2 gigs you have as an email for online storage.
Yeah, it's slow.
That's actually, people have been talking about that, but...
I just haven't tried doing it.
I haven't seen anybody who's actually running it. You mean the download that you can use to back stuff up, kind of automatically email stuff?
No, where it simply just takes a Google account you have and uses it as 2 gigs of remote storage, like a drive letter. You can actually give it a drive letter and...
Right, but how does it... What I want to know is how it spans the files, because you've got a limit to the amount you can attach to an individual email, Eddie.
Yeah, I've used it before. It breaks it up into small little 5 megabyte chunks, and then gives it a little ID in like the subject and then uploads them one at a time.
It's just
but all transparent to the user. I mean, behind the scenes. Yeah, it's a hack. It's
just a silly
hack. If Google changes something, it breaks everything, and then there goes your data.
Is it a silly hack, Leo, or is it a cheap, bomb-proof 2 gigabytes of storage for nothing?
See, that's what I'm thinking.
It's a silly hack. How are you going to get it back? How do you restore it?
The only thing...
Isn't that what the client software is for?
Yeah, that's how the client software works.
Right, you are putting the data out there, and if something ever went wrong with that account, lost it.
Well, it's the same with any other storage system.
See, the only thing I'm concerned with is I would want them to use the Google's API in order to actually make this work. If they were using the official like Google API, then I would say, okay, maybe this might work. But they're actually kind of scraping the system, and it's a little bit of a hack.
Yeah, that's what makes me nervous. I agree. I mean, if Google said, here's your SDK for saving files on Google, but they're never going to do that.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
That's true. It would be abuse probably in Google's eyes, so not the coolest thing.
Well, to their credit, they haven't done anything about it. I mean, they're letting people do it. Probably because most people are not doing it.
Yet.
Yet. Hey, did you see that the OS 10.4.1, the Intel OS 10 is apparently on the Wares sites already?
Yes, that's awesome. I can't wait to get a copy.
Less than a week.
I have to get a copy. Come on. If anybody has it there, email me.
What is this about Apple being a hardware company when now all the focus is on their potential takeover?
Not anymore.
In the OS world. So, who predicted this last week?
You did. Well, I didn't think it'd be cracked so fast. This forces them to sell it, right?
It hasn't been cracked. This has just been leaked off the developer systems.
But you couldn't put it on the system?
No. What I'm saying is they have a small number of systems they're selling to developers as of the Worldwide Developers Conference. I don't think any of the scary security stuff they're talking about doing for the release version, which is summer of 2006, has been implemented yet.
Can you run this 10.4.1 on a white box PC now?
From what I hear...
That's the rumor.
I was speaking with a friend of mine who's a Mac developer, and he was at the conference, and he said he actually got a chance to play around with the machine. He was looking inside of it, and it's just a standard Intel motherboard, standard onboard Intel graphics. There was nothing crazy, nothing special, no special Apple chipset on the board. It was, off-the-shelf kind of stuff, so I don't see any reason why not. At this point, anyway, until they add that protection.
See, the minute it's cracked, if you think it forward, let's say it is cracked and somebody does figure out a way to put it on a white box, then Apple's going to have to do a shrink wrap release of it, because otherwise they're losing all this revenue. And then all of a sudden they are a software company.
I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see what happens.
They screwed the pooch.
You're just not a happy man today, Leo.
They screwed the pooch, I'm telling you. I hate Windows. I hate Apple. What's left? Linux? Piece of crap.
Hey, those boot CDs are cool. Long live Nopix and the other boot CDs out there.
I'm not going to install anything ever again. I'm just going to run live CDs of everything.
Hey, at least with Nopix, you'd have about 2 gigs of apps on one CD. So
pretty amazing.
You have your Open Office and your... It is. It is really amazing.
That's the hack I want. OS 10.4.1 live CD, baby. How long before that happened?
Tick, 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 tick.
Now that's a hack. That's what I want to see. Come on, guys. I'm waiting for you hackers. Get going. Get to work.
Let's do a quick search on that one. So, FCC's pushed up the digital TV signal deadlines. Does anybody care?
Well, what is this? Is this the consumer electronics guys saying we need money? We're not selling enough HD TVs? Where's this coming from?
Well, basically, no, it's actually standard sets between 25 and 36 inches have to support digital signals by March 1st, 2006, instead of, I guess it was going to be, March, April, May, June, July 1st, October, or 2006. And then all of the sets, all the smaller sets, they're going to actually convert over 7 months earlier than the original FCC deadline. So they basically just means they're going to support digital signals on these. These are regular standard. These are not ATTVs. These are regular standard TVs. The CEA was pushing for this.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Because apparently a lot of retailers are convinced that consumers aren't going to buy any of the digital televisions. So the manufacturers didn't want to get stuck with a bunch of TVs that nobody would buy, and the retailers didn't want to get stuck with a bunch of digital TVs they didn't think they could sell, so they lobbied the FCC to force the deadline earlier for the digital compatibility on the televisions.
You know, it's really just to raise awareness with consumers about the to say that, you know what, everything will transition to digital eventually. Here's why. Right. And to get them simply thinking about it, because I believe this week it was reported that Comcast is actually really almost forcing some of their original customers who are sticking with analog only reception in the home to move over to digital. Because then once all the analog consumers are done and the system is completely digital, they can then start implementing, okay, digital on every channel and increasing the quality of those digital channels as well through hopefully more bandwidth.
And the copy protection.
Of course. But the whole thing about digital TVs, though, is kind of like a so what? Odds are, if we're moving to this digital environment anyway, who doesn't have a set-top box? And that set-top box will do the digital conversion for you.
But I don't want a set-top box.
Don't confuse cable and broadcast. This is to convert to digital broadcast technology so they can resell as much as the television bandwidth as possible.
Well, who still watches rabbit ears?
See, I'm all for that too, because my favorite form of TV is digital over the air.
Apparently something in the neighborhood of 30 million Americans still.
Good Lord. But that's what's they're watching four channels. What are they watching?
They're watching ABC, NBC, CBS,
and Fox, and then a couple of UHF indies. God, that's nothing.
There's also, the other thing is yeah, but you remember something, Leo? You're also talking about all of the Spanish, a huge percentage of the Spanish language channels, Chinese language channels, Korean language channels that are locally broadcast to communities are still going out on UHF or some of.
Well, and they need to go HD. Absolutely, let's move. Hey, if you're poor, let's go HD.
As of today, there are 1,500 digital stations. There are 1,500 digital stations in 211 markets.
But it's not HD. It's digital TV. Well, which way is it going to be, Leo? You've just argued one way, which is no one watches broadcast TV. We should kill it all off. And you just went the other direction, which is...
So you're saying this is for people who are watching broadcast television. Well, who is that? It's somebody who... It's not somebody who should be buying a digital TV. It's somebody who's probably watching a 13-inch black and white television, watching Chinese language programming. They need a digital TV like a hole in the head.
Or those of us who watch PBS in HD.
Yeah, but I think what the real market, what's really going on here is they want this frequency. You talked about this before with the...
Yes, they want to resell the bandwidth.
That's right. They want the 700 megahertz frequencies. It's worth billions. And screw consumers, screw the public.
Do you think it has also anything to do with if it gets back to terrestrial broadcasting as a competitive media or medium for getting you your TV the way you want it? Do you think that would then re-empower the local broadcast stations who are probably being decimated by just the variety and breadth of cable offerings and satellite offerings? And
yeah.
Do you think that would, it's kind of a ploy on their end to say, you know what, we're the local stations.
Broadcasters fought this tooth and nail for years. They really didn't want this to happen. And I think broadcast is really now just the realm of local small time television. You know, look what happened to Channel 4 in San Francisco.
True.
Well, that was there was all sorts of weirdness around Channel 4, But I mean, check this out. Consumer Electronics, because the CEA obviously has a vested interest in selling as many new televisions as possible. But their numbers are claiming that 33.6 million, which is 12% of the 285 million television sets in the U.S. are used to view over-the-air television programming today.
Wow.
So only 12% of TV sets.
Well, I think this is basically an unholy alliance between the federal government that wants those frequencies back because it's a windfall of billions of dollars, and the Consumer Electronics Association that wants to sell TVs to people who don't really want to buy them. And neither one of them is looking out for the interests of the individual. They're both looking out for the interests of big business or big government.
Well, I think part of what everybody's always wondering is what a set-top converter box is going to cost.
Right.
I mean, what's amazing is, right, this is the end of 2006 this is supposed to hit, right?
Yes. That's soon.
Yes. And that's part of why I was thinking about this. That's really soon.
Yeah.
That's not far away at all. You know, that's 18 months away.
The chips aren't cheap. Digital TV chips, please. Yeah, okay, a couple of years ago, yes, they were pretty expensive. But when you have cards selling, you can put in a PC for well under $200. Yeah, the chips themselves probably cost no more than, say, $20 a pop.
Yeah, but you're also talking orders of magnitude and difference in the purchasing amount. I mean, there's never going to be a huge number of people, purchasing the boards for PCs. But, I mean, if Sony...
No, but in terms of what it would cost then to integrate that into a television, that cost is significantly dropped.
Right, okay.
It really shouldn't... At this point, it should be a non-issue, short of making it look better or upscaling the pinched digital feed they're going to be using, trying to cram as many channels as possible into this new bandwidth that they have.
Right.
And I've had digital cable or digital, even satellite that's completely digital, and I still see, you know, visual flaws here and there. It's all changing. DirecTV has their new direct-way satellites going up this year. Already started with one, and they're moving to MPEG-4. Lots of people I talk to are really digging Comcast HD over some of the other options out there, especially with the demise of Boom. And
I mean, it's amazing how bad some of the digital cable is that's floating around right now.
Well, the other thing, too, is that they have digital cable, yes, but even if you have the digital cable set-top box, less than half the channels that you'll receive are sent digitally. It's still mostly analog on the digital systems. And that's part of that problem of still having to support the people like me who haven't switched up yet or switched back just because of I like certain things about analog cable, as in, you know, I don't have this lower third and ugly ass menu system being forced on me, or the incredibly slow channel changing that suddenly jumps in when you're moving to a digital channel system.
Listen, I mean, here's the guy who's the HDTV expert, our HDTV guy, and he's still watching analog cable. That tells you something about consumer demand.
It's the transition point we're in right now. There's not enough content.
Yeah.
What is it? Of everyone who owns an HDTV, it's, I think, less than 13% have actually watched HDTV on their HDTV.
Yeah. But, I mean, it was like there's a difference between digital TV and HDTV.
Yeah. It's this weird transition. We need digital. We need digital transmission, and we need more sources like, you know, rentable content.
Right. And I think there's common confusion, certainly among consumers, and obviously even among experts, about the difference between HD and digital TV. What about, now let's talk about this broadcast flag, which the courts have thrown out. Isn't this kind of a backdoor way to broadcast flag if we go all digital? This is the third part of this unholy alliance. You've got government, you've got the Consumer Electronics Association, and you've got all the content creators who are desperate to copy protect everything. They don't need a broadcast flag if everything's digital. They just prevent copying through the digital.
Well, thank goodness the courts refused.
Well, in theory, right? But if you're running it's going to be interesting. There's always been a lot more controls on the HD content than there have been on the standard, you know, digital version of the NTSC content. You know what I mean? Anything that's widescreen versus anything that's 4:3.
Well, think of DVD content right now as well. That was digital, protected. It happened to have one little aspect of it that was very weak in terms of its protection. Yet there's a very successful digital format that we've all lived with for quite a while now.
Well, and if you think about it, I think that by far is the number one digital format and the number one high quality television format. It's not HD, it's ED, but it's really what most people think. I bet you if you ask people, most people think DVD is HD.
Right.
It's true. Most people associate it with just the set they're looking at or the display they're looking at and not the content itself.
It's funny. I have an HDTV and I don't watch anything in HD. Well, women's tennis is actually pretty good. But aside from that, I'm just really waiting for kind of like the HD DVDs or the Blu-ray to push it. That's what I really want is movies in HD. You know, I could care less about TV.
I was very excited. You know, I had a Dish HD unit for review and I saw ESPN HD Wimbledon. I thought, oh, great, Wimbledon. It's going to be HD TV. I tune in. It's NTSC with bars. This is ESPN HD. They can't even do 24 hours worth of HD. And this is the premier tennis event in the world, and it's not. It's an NTSC. So, I mean, that was last year.
That's where the signal you're receiving is 720p or 1080i. But then it's basically with the original signal. You can see it's pillar box in the center with their logos down each side.
Our ESPN HD guy told me, oh, yeah, most of our stuff we upscale. We're turning it into HD. It's not HD. That's the other issue is you're looking at a 1080p, a 16 by 4 ratio, but it's not high def content.
There's some good programming out there, though. Discovery HD is awesome. Monday Night Football is amazing.
Yeah, if you like to watch Cricket's Mate.
Hey,
NASCAR. Over half of this season, it's been broadcast in HD, and I loved it. High-speed sports. That's where you really appreciate a good HD feed.
Sports, the Oscars, big events like that, and then movies.
Totally.
I don't know. I'm just happy for you and I, Leo, that neither one of us has ever had to make HD broadcasting.
I know. I know. They got high-def radio coming. I'm terrified.
High def radios, I mean, it's out.
But. Hey, I hope it just simply improves the cameraman attributes. I'm sick of shaky cam, and the bigger the screen you have, the more you notice camera movement. So for everyone out there shooting home videos, it's like, don't shake the camera so much. Use a tripod. Please.
Home videos, it's MTV, baby.
Oh, when you start looking at stuff on 60-plus inch screens and somebody's moving the camera around a lot, you got everyone, you know, reaching for the Dramamine.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
We're going to have to change everything.
It's scary.
Everything you know is wrong.
Leo, you sound so sad.
I'm depressed. I am. I'm sitting here trying to get my goddamn windows to work, and life sucks. It's 86 degrees in this garret office. I'm starting to feel like Dvorak.
I don't know. Dvorak's a little punchier. You're starting to sound depressed. Is what
I'm just cranky.
Sound like.
I'm just cranky. All right. Well, let's change the subject.
Man. AMD details early quad-core plans. Story up from ExtremeTech.com. So Friday, they did an analyst briefing. AMD said they are making, and this is one of the best quotes of all time, quote, irreversible progress, unquote, in the new architectures. Specifically, multi-core microprocessors and 64-bit processing.
This guy's going to the George Bush School of Elocution.
I don't know. Mark Hockman, who's a guy I do a bunch of work for over at Extreme Tech, made sure to put irreversible progress in quotes.
Oh, I love it.
That just made me laugh. But yeah, it's an interesting the whole idea of like four processors on a chip is a little disturbing.
Well, is it they're just going to leapfrog right over the Pentium D? I mean, obviously this is a, you know, a marketing move. They're not going to do two, they'll do four. Why do dual core when you can do four core?
Interesting thought.
Yeah,
2006 AMD ships its Pacifica virtualization and Presidio security technology.
Is this aimed at workstations or is it aimed at servers? Is this desktop?
This is more at the server end. During the first quarter of 2005, AMD captured 28% of the total market for four-way servers.
So. You'll see this dribble down to everything, though. Consumer stuff, soon enough.
Yeah,
it's simply that it's cheaper to build more cores than it is to keep shrinking the process at this current time.
It just strikes me as kind of capitulation from the chip manufacturers. They're saying, yeah, well, we just really can't get our chips much faster or much more efficient, so we'll just put more of them on a die. It's like, it's a kludge. I mean, am I wrong? Or the benchmarks, they're not showing four times the they're good for servers because you're doing transactions where you have lots of things happen simultaneously, but they're not great for desktops.
You know what the Intel guys were saying over and over? You know, what's interesting is they were saying like the dual core, the Intel guys were saying the dual core Pentiums, you know, you're going to feel a difference as an end user. It's like, it's not very benchmarkable at this point. Nobody's using, you know, everybody, there's 42 different variations on benchmarks that people, homemade benchmarks that people are using. But he said that, you know, you'll notice a difference. And I remember this guy I used to co-host a television program was a early dual processor system fanatic.
That's true. And I still have that right here.
It was Leo Laporte.
It was me.
Yes. I
still have my dual Pentium 3s, and that's why I know how crappy it is. But that
when did you change? You see, you used to sing the praises of dual processor systems.
I think dual processors.
What happened, Leo?
I think dual processors is fine. It makes a lot of sense for a certain class of applications. Server applications where you have, it works where there's a lot of things happening simultaneously. If what you want to do is burn...
Sure, 3D rendering.
If you've got a well-threaded program and a well-threaded OS, yes. But is it doesn't really benefit... It's not... I do think it's in a way saying, yeah, we just really couldn't make these processors any more efficient. We really couldn't push the clock speed any farther than we have. We have no other way to go. And I just seems to me that it's a way of the it's a marketing thing, right? I mean, it's more of a marketing thing than
all marketing stuff. Would you rather they accelerated to a, you know, a 6 gigahertz processor that was 4% faster than the 4 gigahertz processor?
No, you're right. You're right. We haven't seen much improvement. I'm still using a Pentium 4 2.4 gigahertz, and it's fine, thank you.
There's a reason why Intel finally backed away from using, you know, the clock speed numbers.
Right.
You know, if Intel's backing away from using clock speed numbers, there's two things going on there. They're either so frustrated that AMD's, you know, got what? Close, is it, Robert, is it 18% of the market that AMD has now?
Wow.
Something like that?
That sounds right.
You know, they're either so frustrated that You know, they're either so frustrated that AMD has been able to do their thing where their more efficient processors, which were getting dinged because they sounded slower because they had a slower clock speed, even though they were doing the same amount of work, right? They're either, you know, it's a twofold thing. They're getting away from that. And two, you know, if Intel was saying for years, people buy based on the clock speed number, people buy based on the clock speed number. And if they're moving away from that, it means, you know, they've gotten to the point where their clock speed number doesn't seem to be very useful anymore.
Don't you feel as though that this is a good step, though, in the right direction? I mean, we have so many... This is something that Apple did a long time ago with the G4s. Remember, they couldn't really get the speed of performance that they wanted.
But Apple did that because they were flatlined on their processors.
That's what's happened to Intel.
That's what's happening with Intel right now.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Intel's now in the same boat Apple was a year ago. And that's what I'm saying, is it's right. Kind of a way of saying, yeah, you're right. I mean, we're not going to get to 4 gigahertz. More to the point, I mean, you've got Prescott, which is really kind of a flopped chip because the pipelines were too deep. The branch prediction wasn't good enough. And it generates 1,000 watts. The thing's like a little, you know, you could use it as a hair dryer. So
I can attest to that. I just finished building a Prescott based system.
Did you?
Over the weekend, and it is an amazingly hot box.
And is it fast?
You know what? I had the spare parts, and I built it for a friend, and it is fast, but it is one of the, you really have to be careful with the heat sink and use a good heat sink because there is a lot of heat coming off of that. It under load, it's getting around 75 degrees Celsius. It's like, what is that, like 160 degrees or something? I'm tempted to liquid cool it at this point, so. Yeah. But that's under extreme load. Under your average condition, it's down, you know, 50, sub-50.
Aren't the dual-core chips going to be really hot? Aren't they going to be hotter, too?
But they wouldn't have, theoretically, you wouldn't have to run them as fast or at the same equivalent speed if you just have more of them. And we're still dealing with, you know, we've had, what, 2 decades of OSs and hardware optimized for single-thread, single-CPU use.
Right.
Yeah, I was just going to say that with Intel and now AMD doing it, it seems like, you know, the application developers are just going to start writing for dual-core, you know, 2 or 4 way, and you'll see speed.
I certainly hope so.
But remember, it's not the same as twice as fast. I mean, a processor that's twice as fast is faster than 2 processors because it depends on you being able to split things up. Yeah. I mean, if you had the choice between the two.
The processor and the threading on the app.
If they had the choice, I mean, you'd want to have a faster processor as well. I mean, are we not going to have faster processors? Is that the end of the line?
I think processors are definitely going to get faster.
Oh no, what's the record now for switching transistors? 600 gigahertz or 6 terahertz?
Wow.
Some crazy number like that. And then the scientists are just coming up with the new single atom switching using quantum mechanics or quantum spin. So hopefully we'll have that's another way they could reduce heat. It's just, you know, we're in that crazy transition time with new technologies coming up for multi-core. We're being teased with, you know, the upcoming, even game consoles now are becoming supercomputers in their own right.
Yeah.
And Sony just announced they're going to have the hard drive add-on for the PS3 that will include a pre-install of Linux. So who knows what you could do with that as well. And like, you know, most wise people do at this point.
Isn't that interesting that they're actually putting Linux out for the PS3? Is that a developer box? What is that?
Well, they did a Linux for the PS2.
When they unveiled the network adapter for the first time a couple years back, that was part of their dev kit that included the hard drive as well, because the hard drive actually attaches to the network adapter. And that was preloaded with Linux as well. So it was the PS2 itself.
So they've done this before.
Yeah.
And this was a development environment? Was that the idea?
But now when you have the power of the cell processor, it wasn't so much I never saw anybody develop using the Linux environment. I was always curious to see what anybody did with it. It was more, I think, just to say it could be done. Like, oh, you know what? We can compile a kernel to run on this hardware. Here you go.
Or was to say to hackers, hands off.
Have you guys read some of the articles in the PlayStation 3 Linux stuff?
No.
We're positioning PS3 as a supercomputer, he says, but people won't recognize it as a computer unless we call it a computer, so we're going to run an OS on it. In fact, the cell can run multiple OSs. In order to run the OSs, we need a hard disk. So in order to declare that the PS3 is a computer, I think we'll have the hard disk pre-installed with Linux as a bonus.
Wow. Wow.
Oh, Mr. Kutagari.
I feel like we're in 19...
Kutaragi.
Who knows? With enough storage, that could be the do-it-all box. You know, with the right inputs, outputs. Any of those little new media boxes coming up can do that. We just need the content. We need high-definition content, damn it.
I just hope Apple doesn't look back at this and say, gosh, we should have really gone with a cell processor. That would be depressing. Jeez. Maybe the PlayStation 3 is my next computer. Hey, it's a computer, you know. I hear it's a computer.
But the cost of graphics cards, can't believe how much you shell for a graphics card nowadays.
Are they going to have 2 ATI processors in that PS3?
Crossfire.
Is it SLI? What are they doing?
Oh, no. Well, on the PC side, they have their Crossfire motherboards that they're showing off already, and the chipsets that support two cards in the same system.
And it's SLI?
The nice advantage that they have over NVIDIA's SLI is that the cards don't have to be exactly matched.
Ah.
And what else is there? There is...
Man, I'm not going to touch those for a long time. Have you guys run into the same problems? I know we tried to do a couple of demos on the show of the SLI, and it was just buggy, and certain games didn't work right.
Well, at its launch, there were some issues.
They're doing the same thing CPU guys are doing. They're throwing multiple processors at the problem. Must be the wave of the future.
Well, graphics cards, by their nature, are highly parallel.
Right, right. It's a very different kind of environment. Does the game have to be SLI compatible?
Not necessarily.
So the BIOS handles the threading?
It seems to be two different ways that are better optimized for OpenGL and Direct3D gaming. In terms of, say, here are several ways you could think about splitting the screen. You could either say the top half and the bottom half. You could have interlaced lines. You could throw a tile system over it and say, you know what, you do this row of tiles, you do the next row of tiles. There's all these different methods, and some work better for different APIs than others. And that's, that. Again, you're on the cutting edge if you're messing with any of this right now, and you're dealing with the growing pains. So it is being worked out. I think ATI announced with their new system, their Crossfire technology, I believe it's called, they have, I think, 12 SLI modes, quote-unquote. So, you know... And until they get it figured out what works best, what doesn't, if you're just riding that bleeding edge, and plus you're probably using close to $1,000 worth of graphics cards.
So. Jeez.
It's funny, I had a friend of mine ask me whether or not he should get an SLI system, and I couldn't recommend it. I was just like, no, hold off, you know, wait another year, wait till they get all this worked out. Are you guys recommending any of these SLIs or no?
You know what, I'd say we're past that very first bleeding edge generation of motherboards that supported it, so now there's, I'd say, a half a dozen good options out there. So at least you didn't buy it right when it first took. But right now, you can only buy NVIDIA's solution that's mature enough to recommend. ATI's was just announced. I don't believe you can actually buy anything right now regarding that. And so, you know, if you want to live and die on the edge and you got the money to do it, sure.
But we're not really talking about frame rate improvements here. We're talking about quality of the visuals, right? And that's where you see the biggest improvement.
Both.
So you can have higher resolutions, higher frame rate?
Yeah. You can either, you know, have 16x anti-aliasing, 32x, you know, anisotropic filtering, or you could say take that up to 16x12 or higher.
Huh.
And you know, where it's going to become really important is when we have displays that are, you know, your 40-50-inch home theater display that'll do, you know, 1920x1080 progressive.
Yeah.
You want to drive like a 3-megapixel display at 60 hertz. That's where you're going to want, you know,
right,
a beefy system. But when we're talking resolutions, you know, 12x9 and under,
it doesn't matter.
Or even up to, say, 16x12. I like 16x12 for gaming with no AA on a 19-inch display. I think that's where I shoot for on my own gaming experience.
But I think we're getting a taste of this looking at H.264 and 1080p. It really takes a lot of juice to play those things back without dropping frames. I mean, you have to have a pretty hefty system. And so it's obvious that what we're going for, these new video standards, are going to be very demanding.
Definitely. And there is no 1080p format there is a 1080p format, of course, but nobody is actually recording much in that you can buy, short of like the Windows Media 9 HD.
But you can do rendering in through 1080p, and that's where you'll see it first.
Oh, that's the real-time gaming in 1080p is here and now.
Yeah.
And it, for that kind of resolution, there aren't that many displays. Well, PC displays can do that resolution, of course, but actually getting a 1080p resolution into a home theater display right now is a bit of a challenge. Like for that, remember I was mentioning last week, the Sharp Aquos I have in, the 45-inch Aquos. It's a 1080p native LCD flat panel. Beautiful. Beautiful display. I love it. The only thing is, the only way to send a native 1080p signal into that display is through the RF, the digital over-the-air RF connection. You can't hook a DVI. You can't do it through HDMI.
The bandwidth's too high for DVI.
No, actually, DVI is spec'd up to... Somebody, forget the person's name off the top of my head, but bless them for sending me a few good links last week for some good information. But it turns out the spec for DVI is rated up to 1080p. The thing is that transmitter and receiver hardware wasn't even manufactured until March of this year. So
it's brand new.
And yeah, with those with those receivers and transmitters now being manufactured in more quantity, we're going to start to see all the new displays coming forward, hopefully support that through digital inputs soon. But for right now, it's really difficult to find a 1080p display that you can input 1080p into outside of the PC-style display.
So here's a hypothetical I'd like to throw at you. I think I've got a new sponsor on the radio show. They don't want to pay me cash. They want to pay me $20,000 in trade for a home theater system.
Woohoo!
I don't want to have a huge... Well, I don't know how far $20,000 will go. I don't want to have a huge honking display. Would you get the Aquos?
Pretty far.
So far, I like it a lot. You know what? It's the first display I've had in where, boom, the industry standards for color in television broadcast and things like that, this TV, you can hit a couple of presets, boom, you are very close to industry standards just right out of the box. And that's very, very rare to find in displays nowadays. So I know that when I'm playing my DVD or watching an HD TV broadcast, the color is as intended by the people who created it. And I get a really, for that accuracy, yeah, it's not bad. But I'm getting in two more displays this week. I'm getting in Pioneer's new 50-inch plasma.
I don't want plasma.
To take a look at. And that's, that, I find plasma's better for video.
Yeah, but.
If you plan on watching video, really? Plasma is hard to beat.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, LCD's coming on, but where LCD matches plasma at the pricing level and the size level, it's almost twice as much money.
Right. Well, I don't mind. I don't need a big, I don't want a big honking screen. I just,
Like, you're looking for 50 inches or
no,
bigger?
No. It could be smaller than that. I just want a nice screen. I want a 1080p.
Like 42?
Yeah, 42 is fine. I just want 1080p is what I really want. And a screen that you can see in the living room. I mean, so people can, you know, I don't have to sit right next to it.
That's one nice advantage of LCD, at least for that sharp, in normal viewing light, brightly lit rooms. Oh, my goodness. That thing is awesome. It actually, I think it looks a little bit better. Because sometimes with most LCD technology, you don't get the really, really dark blacks if you're sitting in a dimly lit room. But as the brighter the ambient lighting becomes,
right?
The
by contrast,
say if something looks gray on the screen, it'll get darker and darker looking. So your eyes tend to see things darker the brighter it is with the ambient lighting itself. So for brightness, yes. For you know all the bells and whistles of a $7,000-$8,000 display, it is. I'm pretty impressed. I gotta say, I'm writing up a good review of it. And, yeah.
Robert, when I move back up there, can we do a movie night in your lab? Would that work out?
Yeah.
That sounds great.
My lab is currently the size of a closet. We're building out a new facility, so as soon as that's done, definitely.
Movie night at my house. It was either that or get one of those super stable turntables, you know, that's got this special liquid hydraulic balancing in there. That was about $20,000. So I could either do that or a full home theater system. I don't know. What do you think?
I'm buying a $15,000 turntable.
You can. You really can.
Oh, no, yeah. I listened to an original, like, 1947 Louis Armstrong LP on like a $15,000 crazy-looking turntable with probably, like, $40,000 worth of speakers at the Home Theater Expo last year, and that was just a...
Did it sound better?
But you know what? Vinyl just sounds neat, and it sounded as good as you could make that vinyl.
It's pretty warm.
It sounded
yeah.
perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, it was
yeah.
beautiful.
Yeah.
Made you cry. but please, I don't need an $8,000 tweeter sitting in my you know front pair of monitors. A diamond. We milled this tweeter from a block of diamond. It's like great. Yes, it sounds amazing.
I don't know. It's having a hard time really thinking about getting a TV. It's been fine without a TV for this time, and I'm not sure I want to buy another TV. It'd be nice to have a really good stereo.
Well, you know what? At least hold off on the TV decision until the end of the year.
Because
starting from this month till throughout the end of the year, right now is when the smallest of the new displays come out progressively, or as it follows throughout the rest of the year, you'll see larger and larger displays. And by, say, October, November, the biggest of the new displays will be out. And then prices fall accordingly. So
that's good to know. Okay, so the end of the year.
This is the stuff we saw at CES at the beginning of the year, and it is some of the best it's the best display technology ever, and it's now just starting to finally make it out into the market. So I'm never in a hurry to buy anything when it comes to new displays, which is, you know, I'm sure the manufacturers love hearing that commentary. But
what's that cutoff date for buying a new?
Yeah, but we're really in the transition phase of television right now, and so it would be good to put it off as long as you can.
Definitely, but for a lot of people I know, they're looking for displays that are sub $2,000, and or they want something in that price range too. And that's as challenging to find a good product in that category as it is in any category. It's just the value stuff finding for people I find is probably the most challenging part of what I do day in and day out. But like I said, those 37-inch LCDs are coming up from BenQ and Westinghouse, and they'll offer 1080p resolutions, and they're going to be priced at around, you know, $19.99, and I'm really curious to see those. Those are starting to trickle out right now.
So Patrick sent me a link. Is this a Tech TV on this date photo blog? What is the deal on this, Patrick?
Oh, somebody, it's a collection of stills from the site.
Wow, this is awesome. Who put this together?
I have no idea. It's a lot of it's off of Fatty Maddie's jib cab and then the jib cam shots.
And the spy cam, too. I see it.
What's the URL?
It's a Text America photo blog, techtv-otd.textamerica.com. It's techtvonthisdate.textamerica.com. And it's kind of cool. It's like, you know, what's going on? What happened on this day in tech TV history? It's kind of sad, really.
So I have a quick question. How long should I wait before buying a new television? Should I just wait till Christmas season?
Or the first of the year.
January of 2006?
Because then you'll see all the new displays that come out by Christmas, and you'll want those so bad that it'll put you off another 6 months.
See, I need a TV in like July, dude.
Okay, I hear you. In time for the start of sports season.
So what do we get?
What size are you looking for? And what kind of space do you have? Like in terms of, do you need a flat panel or do you need a rear projection?
I still think CRTs are the best deal for the money right now, especially if you're in the right room. I'm tempted to buy a projector because the place I'm moving to will have space on a wall for to use a projector. I don't like the angle issues with most of the rear projections I've seen. I want to keep it like under $2,000.
You know, I reviewed a 32-inch LCD panel this week or last week. That was pretty damn good overall. I had some definite issues, but image quality and detail, even in a brightly lit room, was amazing. And it was $1099, $1,100. So
whose was it?
It was from Winbook, actually. It had some very specific issues that I kind of railed it on. But as a display for HD content, I was very impressed. And you consider that price point, though.
Oh, is that the one that had the shutter and the when it was doing the NTSC stuff?
This actually had a stretching problem or a scaling issue when it came to standard definition content. But if that really really bothers you, that I think would be a major turnoff for getting that particular display. But for HD content, it was spot on. For most component and DVI based content, it was spot on, and the detail I found, it was just phenomenal. But again, that price at $1,100, say, your really good CRT-based TVs, you know, we're going to weigh about 100 pounds more, a couple hundred pounds more, and they're right about that same size for not much. You're not going to save a whole lot less by going CRT at that point. So if we're really getting to that interesting time where flat panels are going to really, I think, of one technology or another, take over the CRT finally in rear projection technologies. It's just they're too big and not sexy enough.
You are not sexy enough. You must leave now.
You know, but you know what, though? When I left CES at the beginning of the year, I was still convinced that CRTs in the 30-inch range, 30 to, say, 36 at the max, I guess, were your best value in HDTV because you get them for around $800 or so. But now that we're seeing LCDs of increasingly better quality and improved quality coming in at prices under $1,000 now or right around $1,000, I just don't see it being very much longer before a flat panel technology of some kind will satisfy you at a price you can afford. And, you know, within a few years, that'll just mean bigger and better for everyone, but years down the road,
right?
But if like I pointed out, what was it, that Toshiba CRT was awesome. I don't know what the hell I'm saying anymore. I'm drying out. I'm parched. It's a head cold.
Hey, what is this about
it's my cold medicine.
What is this about DVD decryptor? What did it go out of business? What happened? The website's down, right?
They got a cease and desist.
You're kidding.
Yeah, they did. I want to know who it was that gave them the cease and desist, because it just sounded like okay, we're done. We're really done this time.
It's like 321 Studios. They're gone.
I think they gave it to the wrong guys, though. Did you guys? I never used Decryptor. I was always a Shrink guy.
What about DVD Shrink now?
And they were based out of the UK. That's still there. I downloaded it today.
And that's free, right?
Oh, yeah.
So was that the problem, was that DVD Decryptor was a company?
They were, Lightning UK?
I'm a huge fan of DVD Shrink.
And let's see, basically they were given the cease and desist, and anyone hosting the file was told to take it down. And the person who is the author of the application said that, you know what, they don't have the time or the resources. The resources are the big one, to put up any kind of defense against this. So
yeah, the CD Freak, the CD Freaks posted a letter he wrote. He's like, if 321 Studios can't do with millions, what am I going to, you know, what chance do I have to fight this 50 pounds sterling?
Totally.
Although the rumor is that Sony served him the notice, and that the slash tide is the best quote, as it is rumored that he broke their new copyright protection within 72 hours of its release.
That was my favorite thing about that app. Didn't matter what DVD you had a hold of, you could just strip it, get it on your hard drive, and you don't have to worry about region codes or, you know, do I need the disk or am I going to scratch the disk? Sure, it can be a pirate tool. Everything can be a pirate tool.
Is this the part where we remind our listeners that this is a violating copy protection is a violation of the DMCA, blah, blah,
fair
blah.
Use, though, for personal backup.
You know what's sad is that Canada, which has up to now not had that copyright rule that you can't reverse engineer encryption, is about to pass a law next week that will make it the same. And you know where this all comes from is WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, which is a United Nations group. And WIPO essentially is setting the patent and trademark law for the world and encouraging all developed nations to go along with it. I was talking to Cory Doctorow this week. He's we always used to have money from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He actually is an observer at WIPO, at the United Nations. He says the problem with WIPO is, even though it was a UN chartered organization and their charter was to promote the sharing of information, it was pretty much controlled by intellectual property companies like the Motion Picture Association of America. They're supposed to be non-governmental organizations, NGOs, nonprofits, but it's the MPAA and the RIAA that's on WIPO, and they got their agenda pushed forward, which was you can't reverse engineer copy protection. So now Canada is going along for the ride. It's really sad. I think it's because there's a legitimate fair use purpose to making backup copies of your DVDs.
Totally.
I don't think Robert's pirating DVDs to sell them on the streets. He wants to make backup copies.
I don't think it's not selling it on the streets that they care about so much as, you know, BitTorrent and peer-to-peer.
But you're not doing that, Robert, are you?
No. No, never.
And Robert isn't, and if he was, he'd never admit it.
No, I wouldn't do that, period. It's just, I'm a quality whore. It's like, I have to have things in pristine quality, and I'm not going to put up with any shaky cam crap, nor am I going to give away something I paid good money for. You know, I buy seasons of shows I like because I like having it in that good quality that's commercial-free, it happens to be, as well. That's another reason I like watching DVDs.
And there are good legitimate reasons to make backups.
That, yes. One, sometimes I run into region code problems where I get a disc from overseas and I want to watch it, and I either have to give up on my PC, I have to change the drive, where you only get 5 times you can do this before the drive becomes unchangeable again, or I have to use some piece of software to get around a region code, or I want to watch it, say, on my PSP, or I want to watch it on a portable format, or I simply don't want to have the disc with me. Hollywood and the people who own the content give me no other option. And I'm tech savvy enough to be able to get around that. And, I don't think twice about it personally.
And you're not alone. There's a lot of other people like you.
Yeah, but there's also a lot of people that are...
It's like, if they gave it to me at a fair price, I can't even buy the original Star Wars anymore.
Yeah. So how is it stealing if they're not even selling it?
But Leo, you're saying, you know, we're the well-behaved people that are disciplined and only back up copies for our own use. You're not the people that try. I mean, you get regulated by default, but, you know, I mean, how many millions of people? I mean, look, there's no way to establish the relationship between, you know, file trading and piracy and lost sales, right? However, you know, I, you know, how many people, you know, and you can get into the whole, well, I'm just sampling, I buy a CD if I like it. But if you think about it, there's an entire generation, you know, of teenagers that look at you like you're on crack if you talk about buying music, you know, because they download it all. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, are there legitimate issues yet? You know, do I think broadcast, you know, television going after people for doing file trading on broadcast episodes is kind of ridiculous? Yeah. You know, do I understand why cable companies are wigging out, you know, HBO or somebody? Would they be upset if Deadwood's being traded online? I can see why they'd be upset, because they want to sell the DVD box set.
Well, the music industry got smacked with it first, and that drove them to immediately start, well, at least nowadays you can, for a fairly low price, buy music online. And it's an increasingly competitive space as well, which I think is going to be good for everyone. And I hope that carries over to video.
The online music sales, most of it stinks. Most of the online music sales, horrible.
But I mean, is the selection bad?
The rights, the access, the quality is atrocious compared to a CD.
You know, we get around that though too, Pat. I mean, I've been using him to decrypt all of the music that I buy just so that I can, you know, do what I want with it.
Yep. I do too. I just hit J him.
But if the quality's not there.
Yeah, I'm using the higher quality.
I've bought 800 or 900 songs on the iTunes Music Store. It's not like I'm not giving them my money. Believe me, they're getting my money, but I don't want any copy protection on it. So I J-him it all.
Right.
You know?
So isn't J-him amazing? It's a great little app.
Now, by the way, there is no guarantee that once we've J-himmed this stuff, Apple won't make some change to their DRM that makes it all unusable. And frankly,
well,
I think...
Well, no, it's ripped it all out, though, right? It's just a MP or M4A right now? It's a completely... I mean, you can never tell that it was ever there to begin with.
That's not true, because we don't know exactly what stuff Apple's putting in there. So there could be other things that aren't being stripped out. The only really safe thing to do at this point would be to convert it to an MP3. And then you wouldn't... and which, by the way, J-Him will do automatically. And then you're safe, because it's no longer an AAC of any stripe, you know?
Yeah, I'm not too worried about it. I'm just going to keep it. You can always, you know, the J-Him does a backup for you. Have you seen that, where it can write it to a different directory? You can take it offsite if you want.
The safe thing to do is make a backup copy of the original unmodified AAC,
right,
so that you, if Apple does flip a switch, you can get back to where you were.
I love how you can deauthorize without actually deauthorizing. Have you seen that?
Yeah. Well, this is, you know, I started using J-Him, and one of the things that scared me a little bit is it in order for it to decrypt, you have to get the keys. In order to get the keys, you have to authorize a computer.
Right.
So instead of actually authorizing your real computer, it makes up a fake GUID that's random. You authorize that GUID, and then it's an additional computer, and you can, you know, get the keys. The problem is, you know, you can either do it temporarily or a long term. All of a sudden, you've authorized 5 systems, you know, instantly, and they even warn you, don't do this a lot, because it might attract attention from Apple that you're authorizing, deauthorizing, authorizing, deauthorizing. So I think it's one of those things you want to do once, and then, you know, decrypt everything at once and get it done with. And then, by the way, unauthorized, because you've got a bogus computer that's authorized.
Yeah, it's fun.
It really works great. I think it's a great solution.
The man trying to keep us down.
Yeah.
Mr. Laporte.
Mr. Laporte, open
the door, Mr. Laporte.
But again, I'm not selling this. I'm not trading it. I'm not putting out
Steve Jobs.
It's just because I want to put it. You know why I'm doing it? I want to put it on that file server, that piece of crap boss, and I don't want any copy protection on it. And that's all. That's the only reason.
Leo went to prison for our sins.
I'd like to be a martyr. I want to see some free Leo t-shirts.
I'll print the free Leo bumper stickers.
Oh, wow. Gentlemen, I'm going to be late for dinner.
Time to wrap up this piece of twit.
Cracking the whip.
Hey, I'm going to go play the new Battlefield 2 demo.
Oh, yeah. What are you going to...
Hey, just remember something. My wife can kick your ass.
Can.
She
knows. Probably true. And how about you, Kevin? What are you going off to do?
I'm tracking. No, I just launched a new version of System, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Let's give it a little plug. What are you doing on this
one? Yeah, systm.org.
Yeah.
This one is how to create Myth TV box. So we start from scratch, show you about the different cards that you can purchase, and then walk you all the way through how to set up your own open source PVR.
This is the system even John C. Dvorak liked.
Yay.
Yeah, I saw that. That was crazy.
Does Myth work with a DTV card as well? So you can pull in digital broadcasts, like even HD stuff?
Yeah, there's a card from PC HDTV called the HD3000. It's a Linux-based card. It works great with high-def content.
Nice.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's a nice box. I mean, it does so much more than just capture video. That actually has a bunch of different add-ins. You can do RSS readers. You can play MAME games from within Myth. It's a very cool open source. And you don't have to pay the monthly subscription fee like you would a TiVo or Replay TV, which is also really nice.
That is cool.
And you were able to get it running pretty reliably? Because I know that was always a problem in the past. We never really were able to get any of this stuff to work reliably.
Yeah, you know, it was actually really hard to set up initially, but there's a great distribution of Knoppix called KnoppMyth that does it all for you.
That's neat.
And you run that, you install it, it formats the hard drive, it installs everything you need, it has all the... You know, you don't have to go and download additional packages or anything, and you just configure it, and it's good to go.
Perfect use for Knoppix. You know, my favorite Knoppix distro is the Knoppix MAME. That'll turn any machine into an arcade machine, and you can add all the... It doesn't come with any ROMs, but you can easily rebuild the ISO to have all the ROMs. And then all you do is you go around to any PC, you put it in, you boot, and you've got this massive arcade machine.
That's awesome.
Didn't Roger Chang build that set-top two-player... It looked like a set-top arcade machine.
Yeah, wasn't that cool?
Or a tabletop arcade machine, excuse me.
Yeah. Well, the bar table arcade
reminds
machine.
Me of like those old Tron or Ms. Pac-Man tabletop versions.
Oh, it was so great.
Oh, you take like a box case cabinet like that with the MAME system. That'd be heaven.
That was a kit.
I'd like to set something like that up. If you make it look really good. Like,
I wonder what happened to that. I mean,
he probably still has it.
Do you think he has it?
Sure.
I hope he kept it.
I thought it went home with him.
It was really cool.
Certainly hope so, too.
So there's the plug. Any other plugs anybody else wants to do?
Hey, go to extremeipod.com and send us your iPod picture. Get a chance to win a whole bunch of free downloaded songs from emusic.com, which has like the entire huge, not the entire, huge chunk of the Epitaph catalog. If you're into the whole punk rock thing, they've got Naxos on there, a bunch of other good stuff. But send us your strange and...
You have to do a new another poll soon.
I know. Well, I haven't had access to the poll because every time I've gone on, the system's been throttled down.
Too many people visiting our damn site.
I haven't been able to.
All right.
I will
fix
that
for you.
Yeah, comments have been shut off for a while.
Yeah, that's the throttling, because as soon as we get more than... I increased the number. You know, it has to be like 2,000 people or something on the site. This is simultaneously. And you know, if anything more than that, it really does bog. So I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm moving it to a new server. Maybe that'll help. I don't know.
It's a skittish server.
You know, ladies and gentlemen, if you contribute to twit.tv, there's a good chance we'll be able to get a faster server. You'll get all of the Twit features you know and love on the website. And, of course, you'll keep advertising off of twit.tv and
yes,
out of the
Patrick,
Twit podcast.
Nicely done.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you could donate just... We if you can get us some money, we'll do our best to get a faster server and better connection so the website won't throttle down. The website's twittv.com. You look at the bar on the right side. There's opportunities to contribute.
Don't make twit.tv,
$2
baby.
A month. Continuing donation.
Don't make
which
any promises I can't keep.
$20 a year for a single donation. Well, we're going to make a promise we're going to try to keep. And you can do a one-time donation of any amount. We know that a lot of you have asked for non-PayPal options.
We are
working on that. Leo's working on getting a secure postal office box.
That.
Yes,
so
we
you
are.
Can send me checks.
Why can't... you remember that?
I did. I forgot about that. Now that
send
I'm in the
check.
Office... We actually have a Twit office now. Well, it's kind of... You're sharing an office with me. But now that we have this, I can get an LLC and we can actually be able to get that all working. Yeah, you're right. I forgot all about that.
We're podcasting to you from the beautiful offices of Twit in Petaluma, California, home of the Butter and Egg Festival.
Butter
and
Egg.
A darn fine place to raise a family.
Quit laughing. We're serious about the Butter and Egg Festival.
Yeah. And I've got a Dr. Pepper waiting in the fridge for you, Patrick.
Nice. Actually, this week is when I go up and learn how to make the podcast happen.
The magic. The podcast magic. The little magic elf. Well, I have good news. While this has been such a long broadcast that I've actually been able to get the Service Pack 2 installed, reimage my hard drive, and now I'm repartitioning and putting Audition on it. So, good news, I will be able to edit this Twit. Oh, Lord.
Excellent.
Hey, how about one of us builds a myth box during the next podcast?
Nice.
Live and in person.
Done, I'll do it.
It's really scary. By the way, if anybody needs an old Pentium class or Cyrix Pentium system, you let me know because I'm getting rid of
four.
Well,
one of them's going in Patrick's box of crap. I hate to bring up that painful subject.
It won't fit. Actually, the...
Just stick Nopix discs and all.
The box of crap is looking pretty good. We've got a wireless children's video camera in there. We've got a CES bag full of goodies from 2005. The enhanced keyboard.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of good stuff in there. Somebody's going to be awfully happy. And my beloved wife says that, Leo, you can give away as many boxes of my crap as you want.
That's it for Twit, This Week in Tech, Episode 9. Thanks for joining us this week. Another episode will emerge momentarily. If you've got a question for Twit, leave voicemail on our Skype address. That's This Week in Tech. Or you can call or fax 206-339-TWIT. Or email a wave or MP3 to questions@thisweekintech.com. For more information about the topics we discussed today, visit our website. The show notes are available at thisweekintech.com. And while you're there... You might want to press one of those donation buttons. A small donation helps us keep this show free, free of charge, and free of commercials. Thanks for joining us. I'm Leo Laporte. We'll see you next time on This Week in Tech.
Yeah. All right. I have a free reign, ladies and gentlemen. All right.
Quick, get the Microsoft
Bob. Yeah,
Bob,
really?
Oh, no. That's probably worth something.
No.
All right.
No, actually, I wish
so,
I had a copy of that.
Now, sounds good. Thank you, my friends.
All right.
Cool.
Friends.
And thanks for setting up the box.
Yeah.
Robert, the lag is
yeah,
still
thanks, Robert.
Awesome.
Oh, hey.
Awful.
No problem. I think the lag is still a real problem.
Is it?
Yeah. I think that's a TeamSpeak issue, frankly.
Well, it's, we can either try using the standard telephone connection, or we can just start meeting in one place.
Yeah, that would be a good way to do it.
Or not.
Yeah, we can meet in the middle. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, we can meet at San Rafael. We can take the ferry up to San Rafael.
We'll figure it out. That's a ways off, so.
Yeah, we're smart.
We're smart.
All right. Thank you, guys. See you later.
All right, gents.
Bye.
Talk to you guys later.
We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Somebody's breathing. Somebody. Oh, so much quieter now that he's gone. That's just that one, then. We'll talk to you later, brother. Toodaloo. All right. Time is 5:55, and I'm stopping the recording. Sunday evening.